Lecture 45, The Revolution and Native Americans.
The American Revolution did not advance free women's political fortunes, and as such, it must have disappointed Abigail Adams and others who recognized that the time was ripe to make lasting change. Instead, the Declaration of Independence came to be understood, as the women at Seneca Falls made clear in 1848, as a document betraying the gender prejudices of the age of revolution. Despite the widespread recognition that women had a crucial role to play in the United States in their new role as Republican mothers, and despite the fact that many observers believed it was crucial to expand educational opportunities for women so they could carry out that role among others, the shifts in governance evident with the creation of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights made little dent on the ancient laws governing relations between men and women, and particularly between husbands and wives. Coverture survived the revolution, even though its logic flew in the face of an ideology professing the importance of articulating political positions. The only place where the revolution had a direct effect on women's control over their property was the reduction of dower rights, in effect punishing widows who wanted to maintain their customary right to one-third of their deceased husband's estate. In a society in which the importance of establishing contracts became a paramount public issue, the widow's third seemed an anachronism, even though coverture survived and even though women still faced burdens if they wanted to engage in commercial activities. The situation for free women was difficult. For Native Americans, it became even more so, despite the fact that most of them wanted no part of the American Revolution. In fact, many were probably surprised to find out that their behavior in war was listed among the crimes of George III in the Declaration of Independence. But despite the efforts of many Natives to remain neutral, the Revolutionary War spread deep into Indian country and forced many to take sides. There was no single Native position on the crisis, though more indigenous nations sided with the British than with the rebels. That calculation made sense since Natives' primary problem before the Revolution was the spread of colonists onto their lands. An alliance with Britain might, some could hope, provide some assistance in keeping the land-hungry settlers at bay. But alliances with the British proved disastrous for Natives. Further, despite their efforts on behalf of the Crown, British negotiators did not have Native Americans in mind when they accepted the terms of the Treaty of Paris of 1783. In the aftermath of that settlement, Euro-American settlers attempted to push into Indian country. They often met with resistance, and the war, which had come to a close for other Americans, continued until 1795 for indigenous nations. By the time the dust settled, Native Americans found themselves excluded from the United States. Before the war, of course, tensions often divided Natives from other Americans. The violence of the Paxton Boys in 1763, for example, suggested the depth of hostility that some non-Natives had for Natives. But Benjamin Franklin's response revealed that not all colonists shared such animosity. In most instances, colonists' opinions about Natives depended on where they lived and the extent of their contact with indigenous peoples. Individuals who had extensive contact with Natives were often impressed by their knowledge of the American environment and their willingness to engage in trade. There were often tensions, to be sure, but there was much goodwill, especially in the hinterland and especially in places where the Seven Years' War had not pitted Natives against non-Natives. When the Revolutionary War loomed, Natives and non-Natives each hoped that Indians would be able to remain neutral. Congress made its desires clear to a group of Iroquois visiting Philadelphia in 1775. At the beginning of the war, rebels wanted to make alliances with Indians, and that was the point of this treaty meeting between representatives in Congress and the Iroquois. That is, there was a sense of making an alliance to essentially foster neutrality. Here's how John Adams summarized Congress's position. I quote him: "The nations of Indians inhabiting the frontiers of the colonies are numerous and warlike. They seem disposed to neutrality. None have as yet taken up the hatchet against us, and we have not obtained any certain evidence that either Carleton or Guy Johnson," he was the superintendent of Indian affairs, "have directly attempted to persuade them to take up the hatchet, though some suspicious circumstances there are," Adams added. But Adams was wary, especially given his understanding of the way that Natives fought during wartime. "The Indians are known to conduct their war so entirely without faith in humanity that it would bring eternal infamy on the ministry throughout all Europe if they should excite these savages to war." It's worth remembering that he's addressing the Iroquois when he's saying this. "The French disgraced themselves last war by employing them. to let loose these bloodhounds to scalp men and to butcher women and children is hard. Still, it is such the kind of humanity and policy as we have experienced from the ministry. And so judging from this, flowing from this idea, the people in Congress wanted natives to be neutral. And so they lay out an argument about why natives should remain neutral. This is a family quarrel between us and Old England. This is Adams continuing. You Indians are not concerned in it. We don't wish you to take up the hatchet against the king's troops. We desire you to remain at home and not join on either side, but keep the hatchet buried deep. In the name and behalf of all of our people, we ask and desire you to love peace and to maintain it, and to love and sympathize with us in our troubles, that the path may be kept open with all our people and yours to pass and repass without molestation. What would the Indians stand to gain from not helping the crown? Well, if one follows this logic, a better hold on what they already had, their land. Because, in Congress's reasoning, if the rebels were defeated, the natives would also be punished. For if the king's troops take away our property, Adams concludes here, and destroy us who are of the same blood with themselves, what can you who are Indians expect from them afterwards? This was wishful thinking on the part of Adams and other members of the Continental Congress, who probably did not even recognize the tone of this address to the Iroquois. The rebels also misunderstood the logic of the rebellion as it came to be comprehended in Indian country. It's important to point out at this moment that many natives wanted to be neutral and offered to remain neutral, at least at first. A group of Oneidas informed Governor John Trumbull of Connecticut in 1775 that they wanted nothing to do with the conflict. We have heard of the unhappy differences and great contention between you and Old England, their appeal began. We wonder greatly and are troubled in our minds. Brothers, possess your minds in peace respecting us Indians. We cannot intermeddle in this dispute between two brothers. The quarrel seems to be unnatural. You are two brothers of one blood. We are unwilling to join on either side in such a contest, for we bear an equal affection to both you and Old England. Should the great King of England apply to us for aid, we shall deny him. If the colonies apply, we shall refuse. The present situation of you two brothers is new and strange to us. We Indians cannot find nor recollect in the traditions of our ancestors the like case or similar instances. Brothers, they conclude, for these reasons, possess your minds in peace and take no umbrage that we Indians refuse joining in the contest. We are for peace. These Oneidas and many other natives agreed that the conflict was between Britain and colonists. But Indians had to decide, what these indigenous nations had to determine for themselves, was which side to support if they had to take sides. The option of neutrality that John Adams had stressed in Philadelphia in 1775 was only viable if war could be confined primarily east of the Appalachian Mountains and especially within colonial settlements. That, however, proved to be an illusory hope. The war, when it began, spread through much of Indian country in eastern North America. And in its spread, it forced natives to take sides, just as its spread forced many Anglo-Americans to take sides. Some natives took an active hand early in the conflict, trying to get what was best for their people. Among them was Thayendanegea, or Joseph Brant, as he's more commonly called, who traveled to London in 1776 and delivered an address to the British Secretary of State, Lord Germain. In that speech, Brant asked the British to take a more direct hand in affairs in the backcountry. Brant's words: "The Mohawks, our particular nation, have on all occasions shown their zeal and loyalty to the great king. Yet they have been very badly treated by his people in that country. Despite the promises that the colonists would stay off their lands, nothing, Brant argued, seemed to stop them from their trespasses. We have only therefore to request that His Majesty will attend to this matter. It troubles our nation, and they cannot sleep easy in their beds. Indeed, it's very hard when we have let the king's subjects have so much of our lands for so little value, that they should want to cheat us in this manner of all the small spots we have left for our women and children to live on. We are tired out in making complaints and getting no redress. We therefore hope that the assurances now given us by the superintendent may take place and that he may have it in his power to procure justice. Brandt and others in the hinterland hope to restore the sense of order that often prevailed before the war began. Trade continued until 1776, actually later in some places. Indians, in some instances, had continued to provide necessary supplies for colonists, even sometimes when colonists were surveying lands near native settlements, an action which potentially threatened these natives and which colonists knew could create troubles. But amicable relations broke down when the war arrived, and the problems reveal the strategic flaw at the heart of the rebels' desire for Indian neutrality. Before the war, many people who eventually sided with the rebels wanted to increase the amount of land in colonial hands. These are the European Americans, the colonists. Who stood in their way before the war? Indians, many of whom turned logically to British officials for support and to enforce treaties intended to keep colonists off native lands. There were many instances when British officials had intervened to halt westward expansion by colonists. In a war, then, between one-time colonists who tend to have little regard for native claims and British officials who often tried to protect indigenous communities from trespassers, it made sense for many natives to side with the British. And that is exactly what they did. This was the case for most of the Iroquois, who reasoned that an alliance with the British was in all likelihood the only way to retain their homelands. But when the British lost the war in the backcountry, the northern backcountry, after 1777 and 1778, the Indians found themselves in a desperate position. Traditional notions of revenge prompted them to continue hostilities against outlying settlers even after the British terminated their campaign in the area. This continued aggression, combined with some particularly atrocious actions on their parts during raids on Wyoming and Cherry Valley, led to the poisoning of rebels' minds against the Indians and support for a campaign to essentially eradicate them in some areas. Even natives who fought for the rebels suffered, as the Oneidas, who eventually went to battle with Washington, discovered after the war. Catawba Indians in South Carolina fought with the rebels, battling against Cornwallis's troops and serving under Nathaniel Greene at battles at Guilford Courthouse and at Haw River. And when Charleston was occupied in May 1780, near the end of the war, Catawbas did their best to get supplies to the rebels, especially food. What did the Catawbas get for their participation in the war? Their homes were destroyed by British troops, who promised to destroy them if they sided with the rebels. Local supporters of the revolution remembered the Catawbas' actions and did so well into the 19th century. Catawbas, who remained in South Carolina, served as reminders of sacrifice to the cause of getting rid of a king. They even got rid of their own king during the conflict. But they themselves did not benefit from the alliance. The participation of some Indians on the side of the British in the Revolutionary War shaped the view that the victors had of all Indians afterwards. In some sense, this development was not particularly surprising. After all, even before many natives had joined with the British, the Declaration of Independence accused George III of unleashing merciless Indian savages on frontier settlers, an assessment based on the ways that many Indians traditionally conducted warfare. It could be added here that the British and other Europeans were often brutal in war too, but their brutality took a different form and thus did not merit being singled out as unusual in the context of the Declaration. But missing from the Declaration was the other element of hinterland hostility, the way that colonists killed Indians before, during, and after the war. Those who sided with the British paid heavily for their decision. Mary Jemison, a woman born into a colonial community who spent most of her life with the Senecas, explained why the Iroquois allied themselves with the British. British commissioners, she reported, and I quote her, continued their entreaties without success till they addressed that's the colonists' avarice, by telling our people that the people of the states were few in number and easily subdued, and that on the account of their disobedience to the king, they justly merited all the punishment that it was possible for white men and Indians to inflict upon them, and added that the king was rich and powerful both in money and subjects, that his rum was as plenty as the water in Lake Ontario, that his men were as numerous as the sands upon the lakeshore, and that the Indians, if they would assist in the war and persevere in their friendship to the king till it was closed, should never want for money or goods. That is, the sense that this is before the war turned against the British, this appeal to these natives, stick with us because we are going to win and we're going to reward you for your loyalty. Jemison continues, upon this, upon these promises, upon this, the chiefs concluded a treaty with the British commissioners in which they agreed to take up arms against the rebels and continue in the service of His Majesty till they were subdued in consideration of certain conditions which were stipulated in the treaty to be performed by the British government and its agent. And so they concluded the treaty. The British gave the Senecas presents, which was a typical way to seal the bargain. But the war didn't go well for the British. They'd miscalculated. And eventually, natives realized that they had to stand on their own. By 1779, the situation they feared had come to pass. The Continental General John Sullivan led his soldiers on a devastating raid through Iroquois, destroying every town that they found, burning whatever food supplies they encountered, killing or driving off natives' livestock, and essentially forcing the Iroquois to retreat. As Jemison told the story, in 1 or 2 days after the skirmish at Canisius Lake, Sullivan and his army arrived at Genesee River, where they destroyed every article of food that they could lay their hands on. A part of our corn they burnt and threw the remainder into the river. They burnt our houses, killed what few cattle and horses they could find, destroyed our fruit trees, and left nothing but the bare soil and timber. But the Indians had eloped and were not to be found. But escaping the soldiers did not mean that all would be well for the Senecas and other Iroquois. The winter of 1779 was bitter throughout western New York, she remembered. The snow fell about 5 feet deep and remained for so long a time, and the weather was extremely cold. So much so, indeed, that almost all the game upon which the Indians depended for subsistence perished and reduced them almost to a state of starvation through that and 3 or 4 succeeding years. When the snow melted in the spring, deer were found dead upon the ground in vast numbers, and other animals of every description perished from the cold also and were found dead in multitudes. Many of our people barely escaped with their lives, and some actually died of hunger and freezing. For many residents of Indian country, the Treaty of Fort Stamboux of 1784 was more significant than the Treaty of Paris in 1783. Here at this meeting in upstate, which is now in Rome, New York, representatives of the United States and those of the Iroquois gathered to settle the future. There had been a treaty on the same spot in 1768, which led to the sale of much land in the interior to the British. Now, under the terms of the new treaty, Indians were supposed to give up much more land. In 1785, at the Treaty of Fort McIntosh, the United States government then forced terms on other Western nations. Wyandots, who were the surviving members of the Hurons, Miamis, Delawares, and other Indians who still inhabited the Ohio Valley, a place where they stayed because of its fertile vales, excellent soils, thick forests, and an area that many United States residents now wanted to occupy. This treaty of 1785 stipulated that, and I quote, said Indian nations do acknowledge themselves and all their tribes to be under the protection of the United States and no other sovereign whatsoever. The treaty forbade any United States citizen from encroaching on Indian lands, and any who did so would be punished, however, in any way that the natives please. But if the Indians committed a crime, they needed to be punished also. Like other treaties, this one ended with an exchange of goods and the promise of more goods coming to natives in the future. Other treaties followed using the same rhetoric and logic. Natives needed to accept the protection of the United States and to reject any other sovereign. If they did so, then they could expect freedom from trespassers on the lands they still controlled, continued access to trade goods, punishment of any non-Indians who committed a crime against natives, and peace. At a treaty signed at Hopewell between the Cherokees and the United States on November 28, 1785, as this treaty put it, and I quote, the hatchet shall be forever buried and peace given by the United States and friendship reestablished between the said states on the one part and all the Cherokees on the other shall be universal. And the contracting parties shall use their utmost endeavors to maintain the peace given as aforesaid in friendship reestablished. In order to preserve peace and reduce any possible tensions, the Cherokees could even send delegates to Congress to observe the federal government in action. In the months that followed, the Choctaws, Chickasaws, and Shawnees agreed to treaties, all pretty much along the same lines. The next year, that is 1786, recoiling from some of these treaties, a group of Western nations informed Congress that they believed that the Ohio River should be a permanent boundary line between the United States and these Western peoples. And in an address sent to Congress from the Hurons, Shawnees, Delawares, Ottawas, Chippewas, and other natives, this coalition of indigenous people stated their views about the end of one war and the desire to end the ongoing conflict. Brethren of the United States of America, it is now more than 3 years since peace was made between the King of Great Britain and you, but we, the Indians, were disappointed, finding ourselves not included in the peace according to our expectations. For we thought that its conclusion would have promoted a friendship between the United States and Indians, and that we might enjoy that happiness that formerly subsisted between us and our elder brethren. We have received two very agreeable messages from the 13 United States. We've also received a message from the King, whose war we were engaged in, desiring us to remain quiet, which we accordingly complied with. During the time of this tranquility, we were deliberating the best method we could to form a lasting reconciliation with the 13 United States. Pleased at this time, we thought we were entering upon a reconciliation and friendship with a set of people born on the same continent with ourselves, certain that the quarrel between us was not of our own making. In the course of our councils, we imagined we hit upon an expedient that would promote a lasting peace between us. But the natives didn't enjoy that peace. Contentment didn't follow the war. And they told Congress what happened. We think it is owing to you that the tranquility which, since the peace between us, has not lasted, and that that essential good has been followed by mischief and confusion, having managed everything respecting us your own way. You kindled your council fires where you thought proper without consulting us, at which you held separate treaties, and have entirely neglected our plan of having a general conference with the different nations of the Confederacy. Had this happened, that is, had they gotten together, we have reason to believe everything would now have been settled in a most friendly manner. They still hoped, they still held out some hope that there would be a way to find peace. And the way to do that was to, in fact, halt surveyors coming, crossing the Ohio River and surveying this new territory, the old Northwest now, as we understand this area, and leaving that as Indian country. And natives feared what would happen if the United States continued on its aggressive push. During this period of the late 1780s, there is a growing critique in Indian country about the nature of the United States, the nature of the society of this new American nation. And many natives who for a long time, ever since the colonial period began, had been told that their cultures and civilizations were inferior, now some began to articulate very clearly a critique of the United States. As Brandt put it at one point, "We do not hunger and thirst after those superfluities of life that are the ruin of thousands of families among you. Our ornaments in general are simple and easily obtained. Envy and covetousness, those worms that destroy the fair flower of human happiness, are unknown in this climate." That is, Brandt here, though these natives are in a position of weakened strength militarily, there is no sense that these native peoples are willing to accept the cultural critique that has been sort of heaped upon them and, in fact, turn it against them. I mean, Brandt, in particular, singled out the idea that the residents of the United States would incarcerate someone for debt, which he found appalling. Much better, Brandt thought, to torture and execute someone within a day than to subject someone to sort of lasting horrors of wasting away in jail, especially for something like debt. It seemed inconceivable. How ridiculous a society would it be that would put someone in jail for this? It was, in his words, astonishing. "Cease to call other nations savage," he concluded, "when you are tenfold more the children of cruelty than they." Brandt was not the first native to make such a speech, and it's better to see his words as part of a continuing tradition of indigenous criticism of European colonists and the societies that the colonists created. Many natives had excoriated Europeans and colonists for the alcohol trade, for their greed, for their insatiable desire to acquire more land, for the exclusive and aggressive nature of their religious doctrines, for their indifference to indigenous rights. Incipient revival movements smoldered in Indian country, awaiting only the opportunity to spread. Yet despite the reasonableness of many native appeals, and despite the fact that some indigenous peoples like Brandt spoke of having rights in this revolutionary age, the victors of the Revolutionary War continued to find Indians unacceptable neighbors. Hostility towards natives was built into the Declaration of Independence, which criticized George III for endeavoring, as we mentioned, as I talked, to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages. That accusation remained, even though it ignored the fact that many colonists fought similarly in North America. Given the overall tone of the document, the potential inclusions of natives suggested a deep ambivalence, at best, among the rebels toward Indians. During the Constitutional Convention, the subject of natives attracted relatively little notice. They were not entirely ignored. Article 1, Section 8 noted that Congress would have the authority, and I quote, to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. That clause defined natives essentially as outsiders in the new nation. When the United States decided to ignore the wishes of Western natives by expanding into the Old West, in the Old Northwest in the 1790s, it encountered native peoples who wanted the Ohio River to be the permanent Western boundary, as I've already mentioned. And at this point, tensions mounted yet again. Now, these natives who were trying to resist what they see as the advance of the United States were assisted by some British soldiers that actually never left their forts. And in 1790 and 1791, this collection of United Indians with some British allies organized and routed local U.S. militiamen who'd been trying to take control of what is now Indiana and Ohio. For the natives, the highlight came in November 1791, when an army led by the Miami War Chief Little Turtle and the Shawnee Blue Jacket destroyed troops under the control of American General Arthur St. Clair, governor of the Northwest Territory. In the aftermath of that victory, the Indians of the region, the Seven Nations of Canada, in addition to Shawnees, Miamis, Delawares, Chippewas, Ottawas, Potawatomis, Munsees, Nanticoke, Mississaugas, Mohicans, Conways, Senecas, Cherokees, and Creeks, met with U.S. commissioners and expressed their views that they would not leave. But the United States government, already fearing internal dissension and problems with solidifying the gains of the revolution, believed that it had to claim the area. Thus, Washington ordered General Anthony Wayne, a Revolutionary War veteran, to lead a group of better organized regular troops into the Ohio Valley. In 1794, at the Battle of Fallen Timbers near present-day Toledo, Wayne triumphed and forced the Indians to accept what is known as the Treaty of Grenville, signed in 1795. The treaty forced the natives to concede much of the Ohio Valley, and it forced the remaining British soldiers to vacate. The war, which had begun in 1775 in Lexington, Concord, and soon spread into Indian country, was now finally drawing to a close. There was no organized United States government yet out in the West, but it was sufficient to suppress internal insurrections, as it did in the East, and it proved sufficient to defeat these natives in the Old Northwest, and in the process opened up more territory for American, that is, United States, farmers. Long after 1800, Native Americans continued to confront the legacy of the Revolution. In 1831, when Cherokees tried to halt the state of Georgia from removing them from their land, they discovered that they had no standing in American courts and thus could not appeal to the Supreme Court to solve their problem. When in the case of Worcester versus Georgia, heard in 1832, the Cherokees' appeal reached the Supreme Court through an intermediary, the result was a decision by John Marshall that labeled natives as, and I quote, domestic dependent nations. No other group of Americans had ever had this status. Marshall's decision represented his understanding of their place in American society at the time of the drafting of the United States Constitution. Unlike African Americans, who finally achieved citizenship through amendments to the United States Constitution in the Civil War, natives achieved similar status only in the 1920s through acts by Congress. Did it have to end this way? Was the logic of the Revolution incompatible with the establishment of a lasting peace between Native Americans and the United States? In the early 18th century, the colonial traveler John Lawson toured the modern-day southeast of the U.S. After going through the region, he developed great sympathy for its native peoples, even if he often criticized their culture. In the end, he believed that they had much of value to teach others, and he proposed a radical solution. Natives and colonists should intermarry. By the Indians marrying with the Christians, he wrote, and coming into plantations with their English husbands or wives, they would become Christians and their idolatry would be quite forgotten, and in all probability, a better worship come in its stead. It's hard to imagine anyone attached to the United States government making such an appeal a century later. As a result of warfare that had poisoned relations in Eastern North America in the latter half of the 18th century, natives and non-natives looked at each other with ever-growing hostility. The non-native, the American view, was perhaps best expressed not in an eloquent treatise, but in a single painting. John Vanderlyn's Death of Jane McCrae, painted in 1804. The painting shows a white woman on her knees, seemingly pleading for her life, while two natives, their torsos exposed and with tomahawks in their hand, prepare to dispatch her. The painting illustrated a story from 1777 when McCrae went to meet a British officer she hoped to marry and was instead confronted and killed by two Mohawks. The oft-told story of her death cast a lingering pall over relations between the United States and indigenous peoples, a sober epitaph marking the seeming permanent alienation of the peoples of North America.